Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That was Bunny Wailer with his song, Liberation. And that idea, the people need liberation, is an idea that I hope we're all going to come out of today's show thinking hard on. This week's show is going to be something I've been thinking about for quite some time. It's the beginning of the new year, a time when people are celebrating, really looking forward. But I think we've really got to step back and examine what's going behind us and what are we looking forward to. And so I want to concentrate some of the things that I think are the biggest questions that are confronting us right now, In the back end of the show, we're going to talk about the continuing war, not just the increased troop deployments to Afghanistan, the increased attacks on Pakistan, all the saber rattling against Iran and what's going on in Yemen, and the continued, even if a lot of people prefer to forget that it's still going on, the war and occupation in Iraq. We're going to talk about that, but we're going to talk about it in a special way. We're basically going to listen to some very powerful testimony from a GI who testified at the new Winter Soldier hearings held a couple years ago. And those hearings were sponsored by the Iraq Veterans Against the War. And this testimony gives you a living sense of just what it is America is doing to the people of the world as it rapes and pillages the world in the name of empire. But before we get into that, we're going to do a whole segment on Oscar Grant. Many of you, hopefully many of you, will recall that Oscar Grant was a young black man killed January 1st, 2009, as he was riding a BART train, a Bay Area Rapid Transit train, in Oakland, California, last New Year's Eve. Oscar was killed for no other reason than he was a young black man. And the cop that killed him, Johannes Meserle, basically he's going to start his trial soon. At least the beginning stages of that process are opening up in Los Angeles. The trial was moved from Oakland because the judges felt that too many people knew, were familiar with what it meant to be black and live under an epidemic of police brutality. Too many people identified with Oscar Grant. Oscar Grant had become personalized, humanized to too many people. And most of all, too many people stepped out and protested. You know, it's ironic because people protesting is the only reason this cop is facing trial in the first place. He's the first one ever to go through trial, to go to trial for committing a murder in the line of duty. Well, we're going to listen to testimony from a lot of people who think that, you know what, this is something that people can't step back on. From people who think that we are all Oscar Grant, that the whole damn system is guilty and we demand justice. That's what a lot of people are out there thinking right now. And as the trial begins to open up in Los Angeles, we're going to listen to some testimony from a people's tribunal held last spring in Oakland, California, trying to offer evidence, not just about Oscar's case, but about the epidemic of police brutality in this country today, most of it focused against black and Latino people. And if you think I'm kidding about that, just try this. Google black shot by police. You're going to get 6,330,000 citations. Now try black killed by police. You'll get somewhere around 20 million citations. Now, these are not individual cases, but references. But it should give you a kind of chilling sense of the dimensions of this horrific crime against the people, this horrific epidemic of police murder, police brutality, a crime that concentrates so much about the oppression of black people and about the nature of this society. So let's take a listen to this testimony from the People's Tribunal for Justice for Oscar Grant.
Just a few words of introduction. We are here today to expose the facts of the case of the murder of Oscar Grant and of a whole epidemic of police brutality and murder. Literally thousands of stolen lives. Families of people who have lost their lives to police violence will be here today to testify about their experience in this epidemic. And we will show how this brutality and murder is systematic and systemic. So the goal of our tribunal is to expose the truth and to build mass political resistance against police brutality and murder. We are here to fight for justice for Oscar Grant. We are here to say we are all Oscar Grant. Enough is enough. The whole damn system is guilty. I want to call Zaporia Smith up today to say a few words on behalf of the family of Oscar Grant.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Victoria Smith, and I'm Oscar's auntie and John Tu's mom, Oscar's best friend. I wanted to let you know that the family want to thank everyone who's helped in Oscar, supporting him, supporting the family. They thank all of you. They can't be here today. And as a family member, I thank you. And as an auntie to the other boys that were on the platform, we thank you too. We're here today to prove that Oscar was killed in cold blood by Officer Miserable, New Year's night at the Fruitvale Barge Station. We're asking everybody to please help put Officer Miserable away for killing Oscar, for destroying his friends, minds, souls, young men who will never be the same, that watched their best friend be executed in cold blood. Helplessly they watched, and they couldn't help him. Helplessly I watched from home in my bed, and I couldn't help none of the boys. So we just ask everyone to stand with us. Help us with this. These are young men, 22 years of age, who lives have all going to be now changed because of their best friend, Oscar Grant. Oscar, who was a great father, someone who's been in my life since he was about 5 years old, lived with me, loved his auntie's cooking, let me keep his baby when he needed a babysitter. It's just so much I can say about Oscar. His protection of his auntie. He didn't like nobody to say things to me that were wrong or to my children. He was a very protective young man. And I do honestly believe you seen him that night on the platform protecting his friends, saying, don't hurt us. Just talk to us. And they didn't. No one gave Oscar. Tried to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Nobody helped Oscar. And I'm asking you today, everybody in here, to help Oscar, help put this officer away before it's your son, your nephew, your cousin, your father, your uncle, your wife, or your daughter. Help put Officer Miserable away. And I thank you, and the family thanks you.
You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to excerpts from testimony in a People's Tribunal demanding justice for Oscar Grant, saying we are all Oscar Grant and the whole damn system is guilty. Oscar was a young black man murdered by the BART police in Oakland on January 1st, 2009. The tribunal took place last spring, and the first steps in the trial of the killer cop have begun to open up in Los Angeles. Next up, Danny Garcia, a longtime fighter against police brutality in the San Francisco Bay Area.
My name is Danny Garcia. I'm the president of Families. The man you heard on the speaker today, Cornelius Hell, is one of my members. We were one that would be knocking on your door as soon as your loved one was murdered. It's hard to knock on someone's door and talk to them right after their son, daughter, mother, father, brother, sister was murdered. But they need to hear the truth, and they need to know what the truth is before everybody else gangs up on them and try to drift them around to the opposite way. Oscar Grant's case, it is not a mistake. It's murder. Shooting him in the back, it's not a mistake. It's murder. That was reading his rights, that is the justice system we live in since the beginning of this era. And it murders to all the people in this country who knows how this system works and in this world. If you think or want to believe that there is some good cops in law enforcement or in this government that you may know, or you may not know, in the political arena, all I want you to do is ask them how many bad cops are in this government that are bad that you have jailed today. and wait for their answer. The only answer they could give is no one, not one. And if you think because we have a black president now, everything is going to change, wake up, people. Did it change when we had the first black cop? It didn't change when we had the first black DA. It didn't change when we had the first black judge. In fact, the whole system didn't change. But we still have cold blood murder and cold blood cover-ups. New witnesses have come forward to say it wasn't a fight on the train. It was a disagreement. You heard it today. And everything was calm and over by the time the train got to the Fruitvale station. Don't be surprised about Tony Barone, the cop calling Oscar Grant and his friends, nigga, motherfucker. That's been going on for over 200 years. And the civil rights era, it is being destroyed every day. We the people allow it, just sitting at our home watching the lying news and drinking our beers. The main news people can't report the truth. They don't want to believe the truth. They don't want to believe that this whole system is guilty. The 14 cops who murdered Mark Garcia, my brother, who was innocent man. He was robbed, begging for help, and instead, he was killed, murdered, beaten, tortured. The seven cops were charged by the OCC, which is your Officers Citizens Complaint Board in San Francisco, that a lot of people are asking for. They were charged with 9 accounts. There was 14 of them and only 7 was charged. They were charged with violations to the general order and all the protocols that were made after Aaron Williams' case. Aaron Williams died just like my brother. Only difference is they came in his house, drug him out, beat the shit out of him, and threw him down the stairways. But they hog-tied him just like my brother. They pepper sprayed him just like my brother, and they threw him in back of the van to suffocate and die just like my brother.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're hearing testimony from a people's tribunal demanding justice for Oscar Grant, murdered by the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police on January 1st, 2009. We're going to take a short break and be right back. Welcome back. That was Che Quere, Interlude by Bobby Matos from his album Chango's Dance. This is the Michael Slate Show. Now let's get back into the excerpts of the testimony presented last spring at a people's tribunal demanding justice for Oscar Grant in Oakland.
I'd next like to bring up Rashida Grenage. Rashida is the wife of Raphael and the mother of Luke, both killed by the Oakland police on the night of December 15, 1993, who's been fighting this ever since. Rashida.
Thank you. A reporter outside, as I got here, asked me why we would have a tribunal in a country like this. Usually we think of tribunals in third world repressive countries. And why would we need a tribunal here? And I told him that we actually, those of us who are victims of police shootings or the families of victims, don't have any more rights than people in the countries he mentioned. That in fact, we grow up with a myth, and the myth is the myth of civil rights. What I learned on December 15th in 1993 is that I didn't have any civil rights, and neither did my family. Civil rights on paper are not civil rights unless you can enforce them. And the fact is, most of us who have lost family members to police violence have not been able to enforce our civil rights. Most of us. There are a few families that we can say, because of circumstances, like video or like other compelling evidence that the police cannot overcome, in some limited cases can find justice. But the vast majority of police abuse, police violence, and police killings are never punished. And the civil rights of those victims are never realized. And therefore, they don't exist. It's something that I didn't know until December 15, 1993. I also didn't know that police routinely lie. I discovered that after 5 years, when I was finally able to obtain an audio cassette tape that was running in the shirt pocket of the officer who killed my son. I had to go to court to get the tape. The Police Officers Association tried to prevent me from getting it. They lost. I won. And when I heard the tape, I learned for the first time that the whole reason that was given by the police for why my son and my husband had to die that day was a lie. They claimed that my son refused to surrender his dog to animal control. Everything that happened, they claimed, was a result of his refusal to comply and his refusal to surrender his dog. When I finally heard the audio cassette tape 6 years later, I heard my son very plainly agree to get the dog. So it was all a lie. If I had never been able to obtain that tape, I would have gone to my grave believing the lie they told, believing that my son was in the wrong, and believing that there was a reason for him and his father, who was in a wheelchair as a double amputee, to die. The fact is, there was no reason. There never was a reason. And there never was a reason for Oscar Grant or Gerald Hall or Mark Garcia or any of the others. That is the tragedy of it. There never is a reason. Justice is hard to come by, and it's a secret to the vast number of Americans who believe, as the reporter who asked me did, who believe that it's different here, that this is a democracy. This is not a dictatorship. This is not a third world country. I believe that too, until December 15th, 1993. In 20 minutes, I lost one third of my family. I almost lost another son who had been in the basement and came upstairs when he heard the commotion and was immediately having guns pointed at him and told to get down on the ground, who saw his father and his brother lying on top of one another, dying or dead. They are still killing people, as we know. And the analysis that has been provided here, I don't think anyone can dispute. The question is what we do about it. Thank you very much.
Closing the testimony down is Opie Santos from the Revolution Club in the Bay Area.
America, 2009. If you're black and a mother, you worry. You worry if your son grows too big or talks too loud. If you're black and young, you learn to check your back when you go to play, when you go to school, when you go see your grandma. You learn and are taught Don't stand around too long. Don't hang out with a lot of friends. Don't gesture too wildly. Don't laugh too loud. Don't have an attitude. Don't get pissed off. And don't drive while black. If you're black, anything you do can get you stopped by cops, popped by cops, shot by cops, dead by cops. Your life, stolen. 1 in 9 black men are in jail. Stolen lives. It happens everywhere. Is it a mistake? A mistaken identity? A mistaken weapon? No f***ing way. A constant state of potential terror. Just walking down the street. Just going to the store. Just driving late at night or in the middle of the afternoon. If you're black or Latino, did it matter? Did it matter that you had a job? Did it matter that you went to school? Did it matter that you took responsibility for your kids, looked forward to the future, loved your wife or your wife-to-be? Did it matter that you took the train home on New Year's Eve to do the responsible thing like Oscar Grant did in Oakland? One moment celebrating the new year, coming home with friends. The next moment, hit upside the head, shoved to the ground, a knee pressed to your back, then bang! Oscar Grant's life over in a split second. An aberration? An isolated incident? A few rotten apples? Not when it's year after year, city after city, hundreds and hundreds and thousands. No f***ing way. Police murder and brutality is systemic and systematic. Official enforcers of lynch mob terror, free to stop, free to search, shoot and kill, all in the name of the law. To serve and protect. To serve and protect who? To serve and protect this system. To keep people oppressed. To try to crush the people's resistance and spirit. So what are we going to do? We're going to stand up and fight back and say enough is enough. This system has criminalized generations of black and Latino youth, offering them nothing but unemployment or chump change jobs, prison, the army, or an early grave. This system sees millions of youth as nothing but a social problem, to be constantly dissed, degraded, and disrespected. This system offers the youth no future, no meaningful life, nothing to live for. But revolution does. The whole damn system is guilty.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and on the occasion of the startup of the trial process for the cop that murdered Oscar Grant last January 1st, 2009, we've been listening to testimony from a People's Tribunal on the murder of Oscar Grant, held in Oakland last spring. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
A poem for Jose Campos Torres. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, tracer of life, poetry, trends, that awareness, consciousness, poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides, they already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't going to write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive, and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? Dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. But the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle streets and their gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond the question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms, the motherfucking Dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggas. In LA, maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggas. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggas. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggas. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risk to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a motherfucking spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the motherfucking street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Gil Scott-Heron with his piece, Jose Campos Torres. In the beginning of the show, I talked about the epidemic of police brutality, and I think that we all need to think about why this kind of thing happens so routinely in America. What's behind it? So we're going to take a listen to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The speech is titled, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And this excerpt is on the role and systemic nature of police brutality in America.
White supremacy is built into the foundation of this country. It is something this system and those who rule it could not do without, even if they wanted to, which they don't. And this has continued down to the present. Despite all the false claims these days about how this is now a colorblind society, segregation and discrimination continue against black people and other people of color. Every time there is a study or a survey to determine this, it shows without fail that segregation and discrimination exist in housing, in jobs, in schools, in healthcare, in every part of society. And this continues to be backed up with brutality and violence. The last time I spoke publicly in this country in 1979, I took a detour from the speaking tour to go to Chester, South Carolina, because black people there were uprising because a young black male in the year 1979 had been lynched for dating a white girl. And more recently in, yes, Texas, there was a horror of what was done to James Byrd, a black man who was taken by white thugs and good old boys, tied to the back of a pickup and dragged until his head was separated from his body and his body was dismembered. So this is still going on in this greatest of all countries. But today it is mostly the police who openly, as the police, carry out brutality and terror against black youth and black people in general. Applying that author's statement on lynching to the present, we could put it this way. It is doubtful that there is a young black male growing up in the U.S. today, in the South or the North, who does not have a very real fear of being brutalized or even murdered by the police. And again, this touches all black people. Another book on the history of lynching of black people in the South makes this point, and think about this. Black parents learn to fear more for some sons than for others. Those who were surly, who had attitude, who were rebellious or were careless, who had not learned the art of appearing to know their place, they were in greater danger. And tragically, parents had no choice but to try to keep their sons, especially, from showing those qualities like self-confidence, curiosity, ambitiousness that could be interpreted as insolence or arrogance by white people. However, this author goes on to say, there was only so much that could be done by the parents in trying to prevent disaster. Any unlucky circumstance could instantly put a black man at deadly risk. And today we see the same thing. In our party's work in the housing projects, one of the most heartrending things we've learned is how black mothers in the projects start to worry early on if the boys that they've given birth to start to show that they might grow up to be large. Because then they'll have everything come down on them that comes down on a large black male. Think of what this means, that a mother from the time her child is 2 or 3 years old has to worry that he might grow up to be too big, so he might be seen to be a threat by the police and then cut down and murdered brutally by them. What kind of a society? What kind of a system is this? Now in this talk, I'm going to be using the words society and system a lot. By society, I mean a group of people who come together or are brought together for common aims and purposes. And in particular, I mean a society on the level of a country, where people live in a territory together and have the same government, like the United States or Brazil or Egypt or China. By system, I mean an organized way that something is held together and works. Systems have a certain order to them and certain ways in which things are done. Sometimes this is set down in formal rules and regulations or even laws, and sometimes it is just something that everybody has learned and carries out without the need for laws and people assigned to enforce them. For example, a game of cards or dominoes is a system. You have to play these games a certain way or it won't work. You can't put a domino any old place you want, any time you want, and try to think the game's going to work. What the f*** are you doing, man? And the same is true of a game of cards, a bid whist, spades, or poker. You can't just play any card you want, any time you want, or else you've broken the system and the thing won't work. The same is true of a game like basketball, which is organized in a different way than, let's say, football. You can't just take the ball and run down the court with it in basketball. You have to dribble it or pass it. And in soccer, you can't use your hands unless you're the goalie. Soccer has a different system. A song also has a system. It has certain notes and musical patterns and rhythms. And it often has certain lyrics. If you don't sing the right lyrics or sing the right tune, then you're not singing that song. Or maybe you're not singing at all. Human societies are organized into systems too. As I will get into through the course of this talk, different societies throughout history have been organized into different systems. And at this stage of human history, there is the possibility to bring into being a radically different society with a radically different system. To get another real look at what kind of society, what kind of system this is in the United States today, think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police, how you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He'd talk about a black man gets pulled over by the police and he has to say, "I am reaching into my pocket for my license because I don't want to be no an accident." You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police, because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. "Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale?" This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. but they got off. One of them got acquitted completely, and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, God, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up. They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway. But you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Look what happened in the Rampart scandal in L.A. They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes into court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Or think about what happened to Alberta Spruill in her Harlem apartment recently. She was sitting there, doing nothing wrong. The cops busted in, fired a stun gun, and she died. Another accident, as Richard Pryor would put it. Another mistake. Oh, we had the wrong apartment. We were looking for drug dealers, but you're an old black woman who doesn't deal drugs. Well, guess we can't do anything about that now. And of course, they'll never be punished. As Carl Dix, national spokesperson for our party, has pointed out, the so-called heroes of the NYPD have killed 37 people since September 11th. And the overwhelming majority of these killings were, not surprisingly, black and Latino people. In Hill Street Bull, Richard Pryor Routines and the Real Deal, in the book Reflections, Sketches, and Provocations, I told about the following true story that was told to me. A rookie cop had just gotten hired on, and he went out on patrol with his partner, a veteran. They were driving around a neighborhood, and also, all of a sudden, a black man came running up the street. And the veteran turned to the rookie and said, go on, shoot him. It's free. What does that mean, it's free? It means here's a black man running up the street looking suspicious. You can kill him and get away with it. And that isn't even all of it. This rookie wasn't ready for that. I guess maybe he's one of those who joined up believing all the serve and protect bullshit. So he resigned. You know why he resigned? Because he became an outcast in the police force because he wouldn't follow the logic that when you get a free chance to kill a black man, you gotta do it. This is how they are. Killing us. And they're not through. They're thrilling at what they do to us. Then they say, well, what's all the fuss? They never have to pay for murdering you or me. Is that what they mean when they say we're free? The role of the police is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the speech was Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. If you want to hear this entire speech, it's available to download or listen to at revolutiontalk.net. We're going to take a short break and be right back. That was Sweet Dreams from Dr. Lonnie Smith. And I gotta tell you, my nights and my days are filled more with nightmares than any kind of sweet dreams. I'm being plagued by these nightmares because it's really disturbing me that we are now in the 8th year of America's imperial war on the world, and it just seems that people have chosen to let it go unopposed or to just pretend that it's either not happening or someone else can deal with it, or even worse, that it's just one of those necessary evils that we really can't and probably shouldn't do anything about. Such callous, inhumane system think is just unacceptable. So I thought it might do us all a bit of good to hear the testimony presented by Ryan Endicott at the new Winter Soldier hearings. This testimony was sponsored by the Iraq Veterans Against the War. I'm not going to say anything more. Just listen to this testimony and think hard.
My name is Ryan Endicott. I'm a former Marine Corporal. She said I served 4 years. I was deployed in Al-Rumadi in 2005. The 1st Battalion, 5th Marine Infantry Regiment. And before I start today, I'd like to say that I'm sharing my story because I'm a patriotic American, and I love my country, and I would do anything to protect it. I deployed in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom on March 1st, 2005. I'd been in the Marine Corps for just over a year. I was a 21-year-old boy fulfilling my duty to my country. The vast majority of the Marines in my platoon were Marines that had already fought in Fallujah, and a lot of them had been in Baghdad as well. To me, these Marines, they were heroes. They were my heroes. They were American heroes. From the moment I landed on the deck in Ramadi, I was so filled with hate and discontent for the very people that we were there to help that I was 100% blinded and 100% numbed to reality. My senior Marines had molded me into the perfect new guy. One that never asked why, never asked questions, and was so eager to be accepted that I was willing to hate anyone and willing to shoot anything to prove it. To prove my manhood. To prove that I, too, was an American hero. I used to lay in bed and hope the next day would bring me a firefight where I could kill hundreds of people to show my fellow Marines that I was as tough as them and that I was a hero, too. Little did I know, many of my seniors were laying awake in their beds, praying to never have to pull the trigger again, praying that they would survive yet another bloody deployment in one of the most violent cities in Iraq. As I patrolled the streets of Ramadi and stood post at the government center, time passed with not so much as a single shot fired, and my trigger finger was twitching with anticipation. I stood post one day with a fellow new Marine and sighted in on a man walking down the street, alone, unarmed, and I said, "I'm not leaving this country without killing anybody. It's not happening." My seniors have taught me well. If you think anything is fishy, pull the trigger, period. Radio report, you saw 2 to 3 guys with weapons. You immediately engaged, killing one of them, and the other 1 or 2 ran off with the weapons. It's as simple as that. We Marines have your back. We'll protect you. No one in our unit has ever been charged in 2 deployments so far. No one gets in trouble. My fellow Marine laughed, immediately pushed me to shoot, pressuring me, telling me, "Just shoot him, just shoot him." Luckily for that man, and I guess for myself, he was out of sight by the time I looked back and got my eye back in the sights, because I'm not sure what I would have done had he still been there when I turned around. April 1st, 2005, as I lay my head down after a 6-hour post again, I wished and hoped I could fulfill my destiny as an American patriot, and as a Marine. Please just give me a reason. At this point, any minute reason will do. An extremely loud blast, and the room shakes, gunfire screams. My squadron yells for us to relax. There's a whole other platoon on post. They can take care of it. He runs for the door to get information. When he returned, yelling to gear up and move, the enemy had made an advance, and they were on an offensive, and were fully attacking the government center. I knew. I knew my time had come. As I left, I ran. This was everything I had hoped for, my chance to kill. I didn't care how or who, but someone was going to die today, and I was going to be a part of the gun club, which I had so cherished. From that moment forward, our efforts became more intense. We began getting intelligence, quote unquote, of suspected terrorist safe houses, weapons caches. We would gear up, blare our death metal, and pump each other up comparing body counts, telling each other it's only a matter of time before we get another. We knew every way to walk right around the line of engagement, the rules of engagement. What a joke. To us grunts, rules of engagement were not rules at all, but merely words on a piece of paper somewhere printed for the sole purpose of protecting officers if we grunts actually got caught. Try to imagine yourself tonight as you sleep warm in your bed with your wife, your children in the next room. 2 a.m., your door is kicked in and men are screaming. As they kick open your bedroom door, they're screaming in a language you don't understand. They're pointing machine guns at your face as they drag you by your hair from your bed, slamming your face down onto the ground, putting their boots on the back of your neck and smashing your face farther into the concrete floor. Your struggle to protect your family and your home is futile as you are blindfolded and handcuffed so tight you lose feeling in your hands within minutes. All you know is you can hear your screaming wife and children crying for help, and you are too useless to protect them. You are not on a list of suspected terrorists. You are not on a list of known terrorists. In fact, you completely supported the U.S. coming into your country and promising freedom and prosperity. You were simply a man in a house on a street that my platoon decided to search. When your blindfold is finally released, the men have left your home, it's destroyed. Your wife and children are hurled in a corner defenseless and crying. Every drawer in your home is thrown, the contents broken, soiled. Your bed has been urinated on. Your wife's panties are glued to the wall. Maybe a family heirloom is missing or other objects stolen. The floor is wet with fresh chewing tobacco spit. And you vainly try to tell your family it'll be okay and never happen again. But in your heart, you know all the while, your chances are it probably will. As time continued to pass, my ego grew stronger and my hate boiled within my veins. A scene like this was nothing more than a Tuesday to me. I laughed as I heard a story. One of the platoons had strapped dead bodies from a gunfight to the hoods of their Humvees and drove around the city for hours, blasting death metal music as they terrorized the population. Just another Tuesday to me. Back on post, there was a time when somehow, some way, an Iraqi had managed to get himself lost and ended up knocking on the door to my post, which happened to be next to our sleeping area. As I answered the door and saw the Iraqi standing there, I accepted my fate, and I jumped on top of him. I accepted he was a suicide bomber, and I had seen my last day as I began to punch him. Brutally, I sat on top of him, punching him as hard as I could. After a moment, I got him under control and handcuffed him. He was simply a man who had just gotten lost. I was punished harshly, not for my actions, not for harming an unarmed civilian, but for not killing him. I was told he should have been killed for being there and I would have been protected. I was forced to burn human feces, stand hours of additional post, and physically punished. I was ostracized and called a wuss and a girl for not killing him. I had lost all the respect that I had gained and that I had killed for to earn. I was forced to stand 6 hours of post at a time, directly behind an air conditioning unit, with all the heat blasting out the backside onto my face in the middle of the summer in one of the hottest places on the earth. I stood that post 12 hours a day, 44 days a week, for over a month. The man that arose from that month was someone I hope to never meet again. The last bit of humanity and morality I had left was gone. I laughed as Marines told me they had just shot this guy in the head and saw his head explode. Just another Tuesday to me. One Tuesday they brought a car that had just been shot up. The driver's fully intact brain was sitting in the back seat. And to looks of it, the passenger's brains were all over the car. I walked over to the body bag with the passenger in it. The bag was still twitching. And we could hear his body still attempting to breathe, even though his brains were clearly all over the car. We laughed as we stomped him. Just another Tuesday to me. These are just some of the Tuesdays that fill a seven-day calendar. I was given a medium machine gun and unlimited ammo and just told to spend a couple of hours per post down at a post that was usually unmanned. It had extended view and less observers that could see what I was doing while I was down there. It was expressed to me that I was now a shooter and was being placed down there to shoot. Don't worry, we have your back. Make sure your combat reports are rock solid and we'll take care of you. You saw two guys with weapons and one ran off. Rules of engagement may change like the tides of the ocean or the winds of a hurricane, but people don't come back from the dead. Sometimes, from 1 hour to the next, the rule of engagement would change. At 10 a.m., someone with a shovel on a certain street would be killed, and at 10:30, he shouldn't be killed. You can change the rule, but you can't bring that person back to life. And when you can't bring him back to life, you tell me that I just murdered him. After returning home from the war, I began drinking, not caring. I had an attitude that ruled my life, where I didn't care if I lived, if I died, where I went, or what I did. As the mental brainwashing and numbing that the Marine Corps had given me dissipated, the only way to substitute that numbing was through alcohol. I started to think back to the people I shot and the lives that I ruined through my hatred and violence, and sometimes it was just too much for me to handle. This war has not only taken the lives of countless Iraqis, men, women, and children, but it has destroyed how many? Who knows? Countless American lives have been destroyed. American veterans, people who joined to serve their country and be American heroes. Many vets feel that there's just no one out there who can help them and end up on the street homeless with nothing, or sometimes worse. Veterans are attempting and completing suicide attempts at an unprecedented rate. That's for a reason. What's worse, to die for no reason, or to live a life of violence and destruction, internal structure and hatred, every single day for no reason? To live every day knowing that everything that was instilled in me from the moment I was born as a free American boy, all the morals and everything that was taught to me, I gave away at the moment I pulled the trigger for acceptance. The moment that I beat another human being half to death simply to feel like the heroes that I held with such regard. I know today that I cannot mend the things that I have broken or fix the lives that I have destroyed, but maybe with my testimony today, I can help one person. That might help two people, who eventually can help four. And maybe all of us together, standing united, can prevent these atrocities from ever happening again. Thank you.
Once again, if you get anything out of today's show, hopefully, it'll be a clearer understanding of why I think that the world is crying out for radical and revolutionary change. There's no reason to live like this. There is a better way we could be and should be living. But it all depends on us and what we do. To get there, we do need a radical change in the world. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank Age for his production assistance and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, please do at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out with a piece from a good friend of mine and an amazing, amazing jazz vocalist, Dwight Tribble. This piece is called Freedom Dance.